Jamaica's political stage has long been defined by the rivalry between the People's National Party and the Jamaica Labour Party, a rivalry rooted in history, ideology, and even violence. From the emergence of worker movements in 1938, led by Norman Manley and Alexander Bustamante, to the founding of PNP and JLP, the legacy of class, colonialism, and ideology still shapes our modern landscape. Wars of words and bullets, especially during the crisis years of the 70s and 80s, left physical scars on communities and emotional scars on the nation. Yet each side claims the moral high ground. PNP draws on socialist roots to promise equity. JLP frames itself as the champion of market-led growth. As Jamaica inches toward another pivotal election, the stakes have never been higher. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Birth of a Two-Party Nation. The story of modern Jamaican politics begins not at independence in 1962, but decades earlier, in the fire of unrest, labor uprisings, and ideological awakening. In 1938, the island shook with strikes, riots, and the rising call of a people ready to claim their destiny. At the center of this social explosion were two figures whose names would come to define the nation's political identity: Norman Washington Manley and Sir Alexander Bustamante. Norman Manley, a Rhodes Scholar and decorated World War I veteran, returned to Jamaica with a vision. He believed in the power of education, economic justice, and nation building. A brilliant barrister, he became the voice of the working class, not through populism, but through principle. In 1938, he founded the People's National Party, PNP, a movement rooted in democratic socialism, trade union advocacy, and Caribbean federation. That same year, his cousin and ideological rival, Alexander Bustamante, emerged as a champion of the street. Loud, charismatic, and fearless, Bustamante took to public squares, denouncing oppression and stirring crowds with rhetoric about wages, land, and justice. While Manley preferred strategy and policy, Bustamante wielded the power of presence. In 1943, he founded the Jamaica Labor Party, JLP, rooted in labor rights, but soon taking a more capitalist, conservative stance than its name suggested. These two men, blood relatives, would become the figureheads of Jamaica's political soul. But more than personal ambition, they reflected deeper tensions in Jamaican society. The PNP drew strength from the intellectual elite, the trade unions, and those longing for economic reform. The JLP thrived among the working poor who demanded immediate change and distrusted lofty ideals. From the outset, the lines were drawn not only by ideology, but by geography and class. The JLP's strongholds formed in urban centers and among small farmers. The PNP gained traction in areas aligned with social activism, education, and unions like the National Workers' Union. And though both parties claimed to speak for the people, they often spoke past one another, using different languages of hope. As Jamaica moved toward self-government, these two parties became the engines driving national discourse. In 1944, Jamaica held its first general election under universal adult suffrage. Bustamante's JLP swept the polls, signaling a demand for bold, visible leadership. But over time, power would swing back and forth between the two, sometimes peacefully, other times with tragic violence. Behind their platforms were deeper philosophical divides. The PNP leaned into Michael Manley's later vision of democratic socialism, state-led development, wealth redistribution, and alignment with post-colonial nations. The JLP, under Edward Seaga in later decades, advocated free market reforms, closer ties with the United States, and capitalist expansion. These weren't just political differences. They were competing visions for what Jamaica could and should be. Still, for all their bluster, both parties failed to avoid one dangerous trap: political tribalism. What began as ideological debate soon calcified into identity. Party colors, orange for PNP, green for JLP, became blood markers in many communities. Whole neighborhoods, especially in urban Kingston, were claimed by one party or the other. And with that came garrison politics, clientelism, and the dangerous entanglement of politics and crime. By the 1960s, as independence arrived, Jamaica's future appeared hopeful. But in the shadow of its democratic framework, party loyalty began to harden into something deeper and more dangerous. A nation divided not just by class or policy, but by inherited allegiance. Families grew up voting one way for generations, not because of policies, but because of loyalty or fear. Still, there were bright spots. Both parties played key roles in advancing education, infrastructure, and public policy. The JLP led Jamaica to independence in 1962 under Prime Minister Bustamante. The PNP, under Manley and later his son Michael, pioneered ambitious reforms in housing, healthcare, and literacy. But even in those early decades, the seeds of political violence were being sown. Electoral campaigns were not just about rallies and speeches. They often meant turf wars, intimidation, and even assassinations. Political gangs began to emerge, backed by party operatives, armed and funded to control districts and sway votes. It was the dark side of democracy, one rarely spoken of but deeply felt. The PNP versus JLP rivalry, then, was never just a political contest. It was a cultural, economic, and psychological battle for the soul of the country. And while their leaders often shook hands in Parliament, their supporters bled in the streets. As we step back into this history, we are not here to glorify one side over the other. We are here to learn, to ask, how did a country so full of promise become trapped in cycles of violence, mistrust, and tribalism? And more importantly, what lessons still remain? Because in Jamaica, politics isn't just a vote. It's a flag, a family legacy, a threat, a hope, a hustle, and sometimes a war. And this war began with two cousins, two men who loved their country, two men who dreamed of a better Jamaica. But history would show dreams alone are never enough. Chapter 2, Guns, Garrisons, and Guilt, The Rise of Political Violence. By the 1970s, the rivalry between the People's National Party, PNP, and the Jamaica Labor Party, JLP, had escalated far beyond political debate. Elections were no longer just contests of ideas. They became battles for control, often marked by bloodshed, bullets, and the silent influence of foreign powers. What had started as ideological differences was now a deadly street-level war. The rise of political violence in Jamaica is one of the most painful chapters in the nation's post-independence history. Nowhere was it more visible than in the capital, Kingston. Once thriving communities were carved into garrison constituencies, politically homogeneous zones where one party ruled, often through fear and force. These garrisons were defended by armed groups, some of whom were recruited from local gangs and given weapons in exchange for loyalty at the ballot box. Tivoli Gardens, under the JLP, and Rema, a PNP stronghold, stood as symbols of this dangerous new reality. The 1976 general elections, held under a national state of emergency, were among the bloodiest in Jamaican history. Politicians were accused of arming their supporters, promising protection, and turning a blind eye to the violence that followed. Gunmen in party colors roamed neighborhoods, silencing dissent and cleansing communities of opposition supporters. This was no longer just democracy. It had mutated into tribal warfare. At the heart of it was a toxic blend of poverty, desperation, and blind party loyalty. Many young men in inner-city areas had few options. With no jobs and no pathway out of poverty, the party became their identity and their survival. Political donmanship replaced community leadership. In exchange for votes and enforcement, dons received government contracts, construction jobs, and protection from law enforcement. The party took care of them, and they took care of the party. It was a dangerous transaction, and it poisoned the democratic process from the inside. Meanwhile, the ideological differences between the PNP and JLP grew more stark. Michael Manley, who had taken over leadership of the PNP from his father, Norman, pushed Jamaica toward democratic socialism. He nationalized industries, expanded education, aligned with Cuba under Fidel Castro, and criticized imperialist policies. His slogan, "Better Must Come," spoke to the pain of the people and their hunger for transformation. But the United States, gripped by Cold War paranoia, saw Manley's socialist policies as a threat. According to later declassified documents, U.S. agencies began funding opposition groups and funneling resources to counteract what they perceived as a communist turn. The JLP, under Edward Seegaw, gained U.S. support and capitalized on fears of Manley's Cuba connection. As tension mounted, Jamaica burned. The violence reached its peak in 1980, ahead of the general election. Over 800 people were killed. Streets ran red with the blood of neighbors and family members who once lived side by side. Political events turned into funerals, and for many, the fear of speaking their party preference became embedded in daily life. Seegaw won the 1980 election in a landslide. With U.S. backing, he implemented neoliberal reforms, privatized state-run businesses, and welcomed international investment. Yet the social cost was steep. Unemployment soared, inflation crippled families, and garrison politics became even more entrenched. The guns had arrived, but they never left. These years were Jamaica's darkest days of political manipulation. Behind closed doors, politicians played chess with communities. They moved resources not based on need, but on loyalty. Opposition areas were left to rot. Supporters were rewarded with contracts, welfare, and protection. The political class created a cycle. Keep communities poor. Keep them dependent. Keep them voting. And in the center of this storm were the children. Growing up in environments where a green or orange shirt could mean life or death. Many knew more about AK-47s than algebra. Political slogans replaced bedtime stories. Fear was inherited, not learned. But amidst the chaos, voices rose. Church leaders, journalists, educators, and even some brave politicians began to speak out. They called for an end to garrison politics. They demanded accountability. They mourned the lost lives and the lost promise of Jamaica's future. In 1989, Michael Manley returned to power with a softened tone. He moved away from socialist policies and embraced economic reform. The Cold War was over, and the ideological battle that had fueled so much of the earlier violence had faded. But the damage was done. Guns were still in the streets, garrisons still held power, and a generation had grown up believing that democracy came at the barrel of a gun. The irony? Both the PNP and JLP claimed to love Jamaica. They wrapped themselves in the flag. They sang the anthem. But their tactics had divided the island, emotionally and physically. And what was lost in all of it was trust. Trust in leaders. Trust in systems. Trust in neighbors. As we continue this journey through Jamaica's political history, we must ask, who really benefited from the violence? Who still benefits from keeping communities divided? And what happens when citizens begin to reject both sides? Not because of apathy, but because of betrayal. The lessons from this chapter are not just for politicians, they are for all of us. because silence is complicity, and only when we face our past can we change our future. Chapter 3. Broken Promises and Political Puppetry. The People Left Behind. By the dawn of the 1990s, Jamaica stood battered, weary, and disillusioned. The violent clashes of the previous decades had taken their toll, physically on the bodies of the poor, emotionally on families torn apart by politics, and spiritually on a nation struggling to remember what independence was supposed to mean. The garrisons still stood. The guns hadn't vanished. And for many in the inner cities, the new question wasn't, which party will bring progress? It was, who will remember us now that the votes are counted? This was the decade when a growing number of Jamaicans began to realize that, despite the warlike fervor of political campaigns, life after elections often looked the same. Potholes weren't patched. Schools remained underfunded. Clinics ran out of medicine. The cost of living kept climbing. And politicians? They reappeared only when it was time to rally the base again. The two major parties, PNP and JLP, talked of transformation. But on the ground, many felt like pawns in a never-ending game. Promises were made, handshakes were exchanged, and bread was sometimes delivered during campaigns, but real change rarely came. Edward Seaga's economic reforms brought mixed results. International investors arrived, but so did rising debt. The poor were told to wait for the trickle-down, but for most, the trickle never came. When Michael Manley returned to power in 1989, he was a different leader from the firebrand socialist of the 70s. The new Manley was a centrist, embracing the International Monetary Fund and market reforms in an effort to rescue Jamaica from economic collapse. But those IMF conditions came with a price. Budget cuts hit the poor hardest. Public services were slashed, job losses mounted, education and health sectors suffered. And the same politicians who once declared themselves champions of the people now delivered news of austerity. For many Jamaicans, it felt like betrayal. Worse, party loyalty, once seen as a form of empowerment, had turned into quiet despair. Families who had voted PNP or JLP for generations began to ask what it had all been for. In some communities, the party base became a punchline, something to be laughed at, even as it defined everyday survival. Yet, the manipulation continued. Only now, it was more subtle. Development plans were used as rewards. You vote for the right party, your community gets a new road. You don't, your community gets ignored. Young men were promised jobs they never received. Single mothers were told to link the right counselor for benefits. The system became a maze of favors, contracts, and behind-the-scenes negotiations. Merit rarely mattered. Allegiance did. Meanwhile, crime surged. What had started as politically aligned gangs evolved into more independent, more ruthless criminal networks. Political dons lost control. Drug trafficking, extortion, and contract killing spread beyond the garrisons. And still, the politicians clapped hands at stage shows and hugged the same criminals at rallies. The people saw it, they whispered about it, but few dared to say it out loud, because speaking out could mean losing your job, your safety, or your life. In schools, children were taught about Jamaica's heroes, Bogle, Nanny, Garvey, but not about the ghosts haunting Denham Town, Arnett Gardens, or Mountain View. History lessons skipped over the decades of political exploitation, as if silence could cleanse the blood from the streets. And the media? Some outlets tried to shine a light. Brave journalists named names, exposed scandals, and tracked the money. But others played it safe, afraid of libel laws, of advertisers, of powerful party machines. Still, resistance brewed beneath the surface. Grassroots organizations began forming. Community leaders without party ties started building youth programs, food banks, and alternative schools. Some churches refused to endorse candidates. University students protested, IMF deals. A new generation, raised in the ruins of the Garrison era, began to ask sharper questions. What if we didn't vote? What if we started our own parties? What if we demanded accountability without loyalty? But the system wasn't designed to make that easy. The electoral office was stable, but campaigning was not. Independent candidates struggled to raise money, get airtime, or secure votes in areas where party politics controlled the narrative. The political machinery was too entrenched, too organized, too ruthless. So most new movements died before they began. And yet, something was shifting. The blind faith of the 70s was gone. The tribalism of the 80s had weakened. In its place came skepticism. Quiet, simmering, and powerful. People were still voting, but they were also watching, closely, listening for the gaps between promises and performance. Some neighborhoods stopped turning out at all. Voter turnout dropped. Disillusionment spread. Politicians no longer stirred crowds with fire. They bribed them with cheap rum and sound trucks. It was the age of optics over substance. Manifestos got flashier, speeches got shorter, scandals got spinned. And the people? The people got tired. By the end of the 1990s, the scars of the political war still ran deep. But so did the hunger for something new. Something honest. Something real. Because even in the silence, the people were not blind. They knew they were being played. They just didn't yet know how to stop the game. Chapter 4. When Color Becomes a Curse. Tribalism and the Psychology of Party Loyalty. In Jamaica, politics is more than policy, it is identity. The green of the Jamaica Labour Party and the orange of the People's National Party are not just colors on campaign shirts. They are battle flags, social signals, warnings, and invitations all in one. But what happens when those colors become shackles? By the early 2000s, political tribalism had taken root in the deepest corners of Jamaican life. It wasn't always loud, it didn't always wear a gun, but it was everywhere, embedded in the way people greeted each other, the music that played in a shop, the neighborhood you were born in, even the corner bar you dared to sit in on election week. You see, political loyalty in Jamaica had shifted. Once based on ideology, it was now passed down like family heirlooms. Children were raised under one banner or the other, with little understanding of what the party actually stood for. It wasn't about policy. It was about belonging. Being orange or green meant you were safe in some areas and in danger in others. It dictated job opportunities, access to contracts, and even safety in public spaces. In some places, simply wearing the wrong color could get you beat. Or worse. This wasn't politics. This was psychology. And it had become embedded in Jamaican culture like a scar covered by makeup. You had the diehard laborites who stuck by the JLP through decades of turbulence, drawn to promises of law and order, economic growth, and international partnerships. Then there were the PNP soldiers, loyal to the manly legacy, seeing their party as the voice of the poor and protector of social rights. Both groups believed the other was destroying the country. Both believed they were right. But most importantly, both believed they were different from each other, when in truth, they were caught in the same system. This tribalism infected everything. Entire neighborhoods were painted in party colors. Schools in some districts couldn't host politicians from the other side. Political violence, while reduced from the 1980s peak, still simmered beneath the surface. Flaring up during local elections, spilling into social media feuds, and tainting civil discourse. Even the churches were divided. Some pastors preached progress, others loyalty. Some spoke truth to power, Others received backdoor donations from political figures to keep their congregations voting a certain way. It wasn't always corruption. Sometimes it was just survival. But one thing was certain: political division was profitable for those in power, because as long as the people were busy fighting each other over which politician delivered more zinc for roofs or fixed a pothole quicker, they weren't demanding structural reform. They weren't asking about constitutional modernization, campaign finance transparency, or the deep rot of institutional corruption. And that was the point. Divide, distract, and dominate. The political elite understood this. They had learned it from colonial masters. If the masses could be kept emotionally loyal but economically powerless, change would never come. Emotions could be weaponized. Family legacies could be bought. Tribalism was cheaper than revolution. Still, beneath the surface, cracks were forming. More Jamaicans were becoming politically aware, some through education, others through frustration. A growing number of young voters stopped caring about party color. They wanted competence, transparency, leadership that didn't come with a gunman in the back row. But the system had inertia. Political campaigns still centered on personalities, not policies. Debates were shallow. Promises were recycled. And yet, the crowds came, sometimes for the music, sometimes for the money, rarely for the message. Even in professional spaces, government offices, construction firms, media houses, party affiliation could determine promotion, dismissal, or silence. People learned to keep their votes secret, to avoid political conversations, to nod when a party leader passed, even if they felt nothing. It became a game of pretending. Pretending to care. Pretending to believe. Pretending to be safe. Because in Jamaica, political neutrality could feel like betrayal. And the saddest part? Many Jamaicans still didn't realize how manipulated they were. They believed they were making free choices, defending their community. But in truth, they were trapped in a theater, actors in a script written decades ago by men long gone. A script where every 5 years, hope rises, promises are made, colors are flown, and then everything goes back to how it was. No water in the pipes, no work in the hands, no future in the eyes of the youth, just orange or green. Color without progress, loyalty without reward, and pain, always pain. As we move deeper into Jamaica's political history, the question becomes clear. Is it possible to love your country without loving your party? Can a nation rise when its people are more loyal to flags than to facts? Because until those questions are answered, the curse of tribalism will remain, and Jamaica's true independence will remain unfinished. Chapter 5: The Business of Power, Corruption, Contracts, and the Cost of Silence. By the mid-2000s, Jamaica had developed a new language, one that spoke softly of contracts, tenders, and government incentives, but whispered loudly of favoritism, backdoor deals, and political enrichment. Corruption, once considered a hidden sin, had become a public secret. Everyone knew it. Most felt powerless to stop it. This chapter in Jamaica's political history is not about ideology or party color. It's about the currency of silence, the monetization of loyalty, the transformation of politics into business. And in this business, truth had a price. Behind closed doors, political operatives on both sides played the game. Infrastructure contracts were awarded not based on merit, but on affiliation. Construction companies loyal to one party were prioritized when their side held power. When the pendulum swung, so did the contracts. It was a revolving door of loyalty and reward. This cycle fed the political machinery. Contracts meant kickbacks. Kickbacks meant campaign financing. Campaign financing meant loyalty on election day. And in between, the public footed the bill, often for incomplete roads, over budget buildings, and ghost projects that never existed beyond the paper they were signed on. The Office of the Contractor General was created to monitor procurement and fight these abuses. But even with watchdogs, the dogs were often muzzled. Investigations dragged on. Reports were shelved. Recommendations were ignored. The system protected itself. Meanwhile, the everyday Jamaican citizen watched as their country was sold off piece by piece, not to foreign powers, but to party loyalists, private cronies, and well-placed friends of ministers. Housing schemes were launched with ribbon cuttings, but left incomplete. School grants were announced with fanfare, but disappeared before reaching classrooms. And still, somehow, the politicians smiled for the cameras and claimed progress. The business of politics became so deeply embedded in society that many Jamaicans began to normalize it. "Everybody eats a food" became the phrase used to justify political hustle. Civil servants accepted it. Journalists, unless exceptionally bold, avoided naming names. Business owners played both sides, green one year, orange the next, just to survive. Because in Jamaica, neutrality in politics could mean economic death. Party-aligned business people were given government leases, exemptions, and financing. Others were blacklisted for their refusal to play ball. The message was clear. Success comes with a price. If you want to eat, you must feed the hand that controls the pot. This arrangement didn't just impact the economy. It eroded trust in democracy itself. Younger voters stopped believing in elections. Many didn't register. Others registered, but never voted. The voter turnout in several national elections dipped below 50%. The question on everyone's lips wasn't, which party will win? But will anything really change? And for many, the answer was no. The political elite kept living well. They wore imported suits, traveled frequently, and bought properties in Upper St. Andrew or overseas. They sent their children to private schools. When health care failed the poor, they flew out for treatment. When crime raged in the garrisons, they called for calm from the safety of gated communities. Yet still, they returned every 5 years, smiling, kissing babies, walking through mud and zinc to hand out promises like candy. They cried beside grieving mothers. They spoke of opportunity. They begged for just one more chance. And again, the system turned. But corruption isn't just about money. It's about values. It's about what happens when a nation stops believing in fairness. Teachers began to look for links instead of promotion based on merit. Nurses hustled for transfers based on who they knew. Police officers worked cases with caution, knowing some dons were untouchable because of their political ties. Youth, seeing the game, decided to join it. Better to be in the circle than to be eaten by it. And that's how a society begins to collapse, not with war, but with quiet compromise. One by one, the pillars fall. Justice becomes optional. Honesty becomes weakness. Loyalty becomes currency. In the halls of Parliament, speeches continued. Motions were passed. Budgets were debated. But the people outside the walls had already made up their minds. Politics was not about service. It was about survival. Still amidst the darkness, flickers of resistance remained. Journalists exposed scandals despite threats. Whistleblowers emerged. Anti-corruption agencies gained teeth. Civil society groups mobilized for transparency. And young Jamaicans, disillusioned but not defeated, started organizing. Some used social media to educate. Others launched podcasts, community programs, or legal clinics. They knew they were up against giants, but they also knew this. Silence was the soil where corruption grew. Because the greatest danger was not the corruption itself, it was the normalization of it. the moment when a people stop expecting better, when they shrug and say, "Ah, so it go." That's when the country loses. And that's what this chapter warns us about. If political power becomes business, and business is protected by fear, then democracy is no longer alive. It's just a well-dressed ghost, haunting the island with broken promises. But Jamaica still has a heartbeat. The question is, who will listen? Chapter 6. Youth, Silence, and the New Rebellion. For decades, Jamaica's political scene was dominated by loud voices, big promises, and deep loyalty to green or orange. But by the 2010s, something unexpected began to happen. Something subtle, quiet, and almost invisible at first. The youth stopped showing up, not just at party meetings or rallies, but at the polls. They weren't wearing the colors. They weren't chanting the slogans. They weren't standing on corners with placards. They weren't interested in the tribal battles their parents and grandparents had fought. To them, the fight between PNP and JLP was like watching two sides of the same broken coin. Both promised. Both failed. Both disappeared after the votes were counted. For the first time in Jamaica's modern political history, a generation was choosing silence as its form of protest. But this silence wasn't apathy. It was rebellion. Young people weren't disengaged. They were just engaged differently. They were starting podcasts about politics. They were using Twitter to call out hypocrisy. They were organizing charity drives in communities without waiting for a member of parliament to take credit. They were sharing stories on YouTube about corruption, garrison manipulation, and voter bribery. They were doing what previous generations didn't dare, questioning everything. They didn't care if it was orange or green. They wanted answers. They wanted results. And most of all, they wanted respect. Still, the system didn't know how to deal with them. Politicians kept using the old playbook: more flyers, more speeches, more giveaways. But the youth saw through it. They knew what a chicken box vote looked like. They knew who was financing whom. They recognized the staged community visits and the scripted compassion. What they didn't see were real jobs, real change, real opportunities to stay in Jamaica and build something. And that's when the quiet rebellion turned into something bigger: migration. The brain drain intensified. Nurses, teachers, tech workers, and creatives fled. Not because they didn't love Jamaica, but because Jamaica's political and economic systems gave them no room to grow. Many young Jamaicans would rather clean hotel rooms abroad than beg for opportunity at home. It was a different kind of protest, a silent departure, a rejection of political manipulation not through violence, but through absence. Yet, some stayed. Some fought from within. They launched civic education campaigns. They exposed nepotism in government hiring. They organized youth debates and ran for student leadership without party backing. A few even entered local politics, refusing to declare party affiliation, standing on platforms of transparency and community service. It wasn't easy. The old guard labeled them naive or disrespectful. Others laughed and asked, "Which party back you?" Because in Jamaica, it was still hard to believe that someone could enter politics without a hidden agenda or a party puppet string. But the youth kept pushing. They spoke the language of climate justice, gender equity, entrepreneurship, and mental health. They talked about things traditional politicians ignored. They didn't want handouts. They wanted systems that worked. Still, many older Jamaicans dismissed them, said they were too soft, too online, too disconnected from real life. But what those critics didn't see was the fire building underneath. The new generation was angry, but not just at poverty. They were angry at betrayal. They were born into debt they didn't create. They inherited garrisons they didn't build. They were taught nationalism, but shown favoritism. They were promised education, but given overcrowded classrooms and underpaid teachers. They were told Jamaica was the place of choice to live, work, and raise families. But their daily lives told a different story. So they fought back in the only way they could, by refusing to play the game. Some joined activism. Others joined music. Some became entrepreneurs. Some turned to prayer. And some, sadly, turned to crime. Not out of rebellion, but out of hopelessness. And through it all, the political class barely changed. They still debated loudly in Parliament, still blamed each other for national failures, still took photos cutting ribbons and handing out keys. But in the background, a quiet storm brewed. A generation with nothing left to lose. A generation unafraid to call out hypocrisy. A generation that may not march in the streets, but will flood the comments, shut down a press conference, or expose a scandal in a viral thread. This is the new rebellion. It doesn't wave a party flag. It waves a phone, a camera, a voice. And it asks a simple question. If democracy really means rule by the people, then why do the people feel powerless? Because one day, soon, this generation will take over. And they won't be asking for permission. They'll be demanding accountability. And unlike the old politicians, they'll know exactly how the system works. Because they've lived through its failures, and they're done pretending. Chapter 7, The Fork in the Road. A nation's choice between healing and repeating. Jamaica stands at a crossroads. After decades of political rivalry, bloodshed, broken promises, and quiet rebellion, the country now faces a choice that cannot be delayed. It is no longer just a question of whether the People's National Party or the Jamaica Labour Party will win the next election. It is a question of whether Jamaica will choose to evolve or continue to circle the same drain of division, tribalism, and manipulation. This moment calls for more than political change. It calls for national reflection. For too long, Jamaicans have been told they must choose between two sides, orange or green. But the real choice has always been between vision and survival, between short-term handouts and long-term transformation, between fear of the other side and faith in a united future. And in recent years, the cracks have deepened. The cost of living has soared. The dollar has weakened. Crime remains a daily threat. And trust in leadership has eroded so severely that many Jamaicans cannot name one politician they genuinely believe in. Not one leader they'd follow without suspicion. Not one voice they'd trust with their child's future. That level of distrust is not accidental. It's the result of decades of manipulation, of weaponized loyalty, of feeding citizens just enough to keep them quiet, but never enough to make them truly free. And now? Now the people are waking up. Slowly, painfully, but undeniably. From town halls to taxi stands, from Twitter threads to church pews, the conversations are shifting. People are no longer just asking, which party can win? They're asking, which party will serve? Which leader has integrity? Which policies actually work for the people, not just for donors and deal-makers? And still, the political class fights to hold on to the old script. They weaponize poverty with promises. They weaponize community need with contracts. They weaponize history with slogans. But something has changed. A younger generation is building parallel systems of education, of support, of accountability. They are teaching each other how government really works, how procurement really works, how elections are really won. And in that knowledge, they are finding something rare. Power. Not the kind handed out by party bosses, but the kind built through awareness, community, and fearless honesty. The question now is whether the rest of the country is ready to follow. To confront the uncomfortable truths about how deeply politics and crime are still intertwined. To acknowledge that both parties have failed in ways too dangerous to ignore. To admit that real change cannot come from another catchy slogan or road paving scheme, but from cultural surgery, from ripping out the root of tribalism and planting something healthier, braver, and freer. That takes courage. It takes sacrifice. It means telling the truth even when it offends your favorite politician. It means voting for ideas, not colors. It means holding your own side accountable, not just the other. It means reimagining what politics can be in Jamaica, not transactional, but transformational. And it means realizing that real progress is not a handout, but a right. In the end, the future will not be decided by Parliament alone. It will be decided by the people, by whether they choose silence or voice, fear or faith, convenience or courage. Because Jamaica is not the sum of its parties. It is the sum of its people. And if the people ever unite, not just against each other, but against injustice, corruption, and manipulation, then the next chapter will not be written in green or orange. It will be written in gold. The color of sunlight. The color of healing. The color of a nation finally choosing itself.